this week on the IoT podcast.
The concept was actually incubated in a university, our founder, Carol Meserich, probably about 15 years ago, which was to automate doing designs for a microprocessor. And that automation was really just designed to make it easier to make complex electronics.
Why it's so important to put provisions in place on cybersecurity measures.
Common vulnerabilities and exposures, CVEs. They've been growing, I think, geometrically for the last 20 years, maybe exponentially. There's just a driving force to do it. These hacks are typically economic or political, warfare-based. That's the biggest issue.
Well, if you could explain a little bit about what Cherry is and, you know, why it's here.
And a lot of how systems are attacked is basically because of our long legacy in computer processors, in computer languages. The Cherry project was sort of kicked off to look at, you know, how are systems attacked and really what can you do to make it harder, much harder, to protect. Cherry is mainly about memory protection. So it's like, how do you stop that happening? How do you stop those buffer overflow attacks or memory-related attacks?
Are you seeing security now by customers being more at the forefront of their mind?
Major corporations are going to have to make a choice. Do we go with a Cherry-based solution to stop 70 or 80% of these CVEs, or do we not? So I think it's going to be the consumers who are going to get frustrated with it, especially critical infrastructure. I think it's going to start to be mandated.
Welcome back to the IoT podcast. I'm your host, Tom White. Every week, we are joined by the biggest names in IoT to unravel the trends, misconceptions, and predictions for the Internet of Things. Before we get into today's episode, don't forget to subscribe on whichever platform you're watching or listening on, and turn on that notification bell so you're never out of the loop. Are we prepared for the cyber threats lurking in the shadows? In this episode, I'm joined with Ron Black, CEO, and Carl Shaw, Safety and Security Architect at Codasip, to explore Cherry, a groundbreaking innovation from Codasip that is revolutionizing cybersecurity. Shockingly, 70% of cyber attacks exploit vulnerabilities related to memory manipulation. Cherry is specifically engineered to defend against these vulnerabilities and many others. So why hasn't Cherry been widely available until now? And what does the future hold for cybersecurity with technologies like Cherry leading the change? I guess we'll find out.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming on to the IoT podcast.
Very pleased to be here.
Yep, good to be here.
Ron and Carl, Codasip, could you explain who you are, your backgrounds, and how you got into this wonderful world of IoT? And if maybe we could start with you, Ron.
Sure. So I've been in the tech space for a long time now, probably over 30 years. I started as an engineer. I was bad at it, so I got assigned to management in my first jobs, and I've not looked best for those 30 years. Most of my stuff has been working with companies going through transformations. I started with bigger companies, and over the last 30-some years, I've worked more and more with smaller companies. I actually started working with Codasip as a customer. And I was amazed as a customer that their product, which was an EDA tool and RISC-V IP, actually worked. Because most of the companies that I worked with, especially in EDA, the new stuff didn't really work. And we were working on some security technologies. This was before Codasip. And I joined Codasip a few years ago as the chairman, actually, and then moved into the CEO.
Yeah, fantastic. For our listeners that may not know what EDA is,
electronic design automation. It's the software that people use to design chips.
Excellent.
It's rather complicated when you put together 40 billion transistors, so you need software to help you do it.
I could imagine so. And your story resembles mine. I remember I studied embedded engineering. I wasn't very good at that either, actually. Decided to go down a very different path. Thank you for that, Ron. And Carl, how about yourself?
I suppose I have gone down the technical route very much, so... So I actually started as a scientist, as a physicist in defense. And then I was involved a lot with developing embedded systems and complex electronics. And I moved from the sort of public-private sector into the private sector, where I worked at ST Microelectronics. And then within that, that was very much chip orientated. We worked in the pay TV division, so all about, you know, your Sky Sports and all of these networked video systems. And within that, yeah, I worked on operating systems and got deeper and deeper into software and security, because security is very important in pay TV systems. And then once I left ST Microelectronics, I set up a security software security consultancy. And then I went through that one, started another software consultancy as well after that from security. And then I got acquired by Codisip nearly 2 years ago.
So we're stuck together.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I remember Carl from the pay TV industry many, many years ago. I don't know if I actually met you at ST or it was just after.
It was just after.
Yeah, it was just after. Yeah, sure. Old friends. Well, thank you both for coming on to the podcast and for giving a bit of a background to yourselves individually. So on to Codisip then. So we've touched upon it briefly there, Ron, with, you know, the EDA and the security aspects and how you were originally a customer. But could you give a bit of an overview on the wider business and what it does?
Yeah, sure. So the concept was actually incubated in a university. Our founder, Carol Meserich, it was really a brilliant idea probably about 15 years ago, which was to automate doing designs for microprocessors, kind of the brains of all chips. And in many of the SoCs, they're so complex, you have many microprocessors in them. And that automation was really just designed to make it easier to make complex electronics. And that got a lot of interest from some investors here in Europe. And it's just kind of spiraled from that. Some of the backing was also when we used the EDA tools called Studio. And there is a C-based programming language called CODAL. So you write the processors in CODAL, and it's interpreted by Studio. And Studio outputs, interestingly, a hardware development kit, which includes RTL, register transfer level. It's a detailed language that you use to make the hardware, make the chips. And it also goes through an intermediate, that high-level language representation that comes out to a compiler, a low-level virtual machine LLVM compiler, so you can have the software tool chain. So that was the concept, and it really took off about 10 years ago when RISC-V, which is an open instruction set architecture, not open source, a little bit different. Mm. The instruction set architecture just allows anybody, it's kind of like the alphabet that you have to make processors. And as an open ISA, that became a specialty. So we actually, in Codisip, use the tool Studio to create RISC-V-based processors, and then we license the processor and the tool, or either individually. We have customers that just use one. And what we're really special about that is we allow customers to customize the processor, what we call custom compute. And that, when actually I started working on this as a customer, not because we needed to do some customizations to fix some security problems in the particular processors, but today it's even more interesting because of the end of Moore's law, Dennard scaling, Amdahl's law, if your audience knows those things. And so when you have this end of Moore's law, it means it's just not cost effective to keep on getting higher and higher performance. It's that you can do it, but it costs a lot of money. And there's kind of three ways to fix the end of Moore's law, Dennard power scaling, and Amdahl's law. One way is you can get rid of electrons and switch to photons. So true optical computing, which there's a lot of companies looking at that, but it's to be mainstream decades away. Yeah. The other is you can look at exotic materials. Carbon nanotubes have been talked about. They have very interesting things. If you take graphene and you, depending on how you roll it up, you end up with different chirality is the chemist physic word for it. So the p orbitals overlap differently, and you can go from conductive to semiconductive. And you could use things like that, but you know that's been going on for 30 years, and every year it's 3 or 5 years later. So exotic materials, it's kind of hard. The other way to fix this problem is to actually co-develop hardware and software together and customize the hardware with the software. So that's what we call custom compute. Some of the automotive industry talks about software-driven chip design. Some companies call it heterogeneous design. Yeah. So there's different words that people use. Domain-specific computing is another word. Yeah, it's really when you customize the chip. Now, customization has been done forever. Customized software, customized boards, customized SoCs, but you have very little customized processors. There's only a few companies doing it. But we believe over the next 5 or 10 years, everybody's going to start to move to it because the end of Moore's Law and those type of challenges.
That's really interesting how you explain that, actually. And thank you for doing so. We know of businesses through the podcast who are using graphene, for instance, and there's a local business here, actually, based out of one of the incubators at the university. And I've known people go into photonics as well. And it does seem as this fairly, you know, esoteric or theoretical way of doing things. So it's interesting that you should bring that up in that introduction there. Carl, moving on to you, you know, why is it that, these previous potential solutions haven't really made it? And, you know, you are focusing on what you're focusing on from a more of a technical aspect.
Yeah, I guess probably what it comes down to is cost.
Yes.
You know, fundamentally, it's all about cost. When you look at these exotic processes, at the moment, they're not cost effective. Things like optics as well. Some parts you can convert, like an ALU, for instance, the arithmetic logic operations you can do, but storage, well, how do you do that in an optical system? And at some point, you also have to get data in and out of a system. So at some point, you tend to merge traditional silicon with these more exotic technologies, and that caused a bottleneck automatically anyway. So it limits things. So that's what we see generally.
That's so fantastic. And I guess that kind of brings us on to setting the scene as the overall reason, and we don't need to delve deep on this with most of our viewers and listeners who understand the need for cybersecurity, but this is a growing problem, and we shouldn't overlook that, right? And why is it a growing problem, Ron, in your eyes, and why it's so important to put the provisions in place from cybersecurity measure?
Yeah, well, I think if you just look at the data, the common vulnerabilities and exposures, CVEs, they've been growing, I think, geometrically for the last 20 years, maybe exponentially, depending
closer on... Closer to exponentially.
Closer to exponentially. So there's just a driving force to do it. I mean, in terms of the reasons that you have these hacks are typically economic or political. And by political, I typically mean warfare-based, which is politics by another means. So it's just a way to make money. People capitalize on it. And you start to see more and more organized crime going into it. It's a bigger thing. In terms of the conflict areas, I think that's probably the most scary part, and I think it's going to accelerate. So I think we're into one of the most difficult, unstable times of my entire lifetime, probably since the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was before I was born. We're very familiar here in Europe with the war in Ukraine, certainly the Israel situation now, but there's many others that people don't typically know about. The war in Syria, the civil war, that's been going on for 12 years, I think, now. The situation in Yemen and the Red Sea with all of the issues that are kind of an extension of the war in Gaza. The Sahel region in Africa, probably people don't think about that. In Azerbaijan, there was a conflict there recently between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Then, of course, we have the constant threats to have conflicts in Taiwan or in the South China Sea, where China has a different opinion in ownership to the shipping rights in those different areas. And there's been a lot of conflict with the Philippines and with Vietnam. So those type of things, especially in today's warfare, there's a lot of risk for cyber attacks. In fact, I would say both in the 2014 invasion of Crimea and the Donbass in the Ukraine, and of course the 2022 one that is more recent with us, both of those were preceded by major cyber attacks. So I think that's the biggest issue that's probably we're facing. And so from an IoT standpoint, especially a critical infrastructure IoT, that's what you target, right? To have absolute chaos, right, in any population prior to an invasion. It's an obvious aspect to it. So we take that very seriously. That's actually why we acquired Cerberus, right, Carl's old company and the team. Yeah. And we've invested heavily in this thing called Cherry, capability hardware extended risk instructions that we can talk about a little bit more on. But I think it's going to be a scary the next decade.
Yeah, it's quite sobering when you say that. With the multitude of conflicts, and not to take a take anything away from some of those conflicts, but you think, oh, you know, that is still happening, right? Of course, and then it's compiled with others and others, etc. But I think one of the things that you mentioned at the start there, Ron, was around organized crime as well. So, you know, we will move to a cashless society at some point, and that is just going to force crime purely in into the wires, right? And so, you know, you've got the coalition of those two things, both from a warfare perspective, but also from organized crime. So you've touched on it there, and with Cherry in particular, and that's, you know, one of the things that we're going to deep dive into. Mm. And maybe Carl, if you can explain a little bit about what Cherry is and, you know, why it's here, and hopefully if it's going to help combat some of the issues that we face in the world at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. So
no pressure.
Yeah, to explain in a short amount of time, it's, I guess, taking a step back is we have to look at how systems are attacked, you know, and a lot of how systems are attacked is basically because of our, you know, long legacy in computer processors, in computer languages. You know, a lot of stuff that we're using now in our IoT systems was developed, you know, way before I was born even, you know. You're talking about things that came from the 50s, 60s, languages like C from the 70s, you know, it's been around way more than 50 years now, I guess. Yeah. So, and obviously when those things were first put in place, security wasn't a pressing concern at the time. They didn't think these things were all going to be combined in a huge network and they would become so vulnerable as they are. I mean, in those days, you had a large mainframe that sat in a building with a locked door. So, and even fairly recently, you know, you had your PC that sat in your desk, wasn't network connected, but now IoT, everything's connected. And it goes to the crime thing, you know, the reason it's interesting for criminals is that it's scales up hugely, and it's low risk as far as the crime goes. So you've got this history in computing, really, and where we are now. One of the things we have to look at in security is how do we address this sort of legacy that we've carried forward with us, as I say, both in terms of the hardware and the software. So the Cherry project was sort of kicked off to look at, you know, how are systems attacked and really what can you do to make it harder, much harder to protect, first of all, at a hardware level, what's happening, but also to address the problems in the languages that we've been using up until now. So, and particularly C and C++, which are still by far the dominant languages in embedded systems. So as for Cherry itself, well, one of the main ways of attacking a system is through memory vulnerabilities. And most people have heard of things like buffer overflow attacks. And that's where you define a region of memory that normally you think, oh, everything's going to go within that. But an attacker comes along and finds some way of going outside of that region of memory. And that once they get outside of that region of memory, they trample over either, you know, important variables, or they can put code in for the CPU to execute by some means. So, so Cherry is mainly about memory protection. So it's like, how do you stop that happening? How do you stop those buffer overflow attacks or memory related attacks? And we do this in the hardware because, you know, you, there's only so far you can go with the software. Any sort of software protection mechanism is limited. It's always going to be limited. It'll either have a performance impact or it won't be as robust as what you can do at the very lowest level in the hardware. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So in our sort of normal CPU architectures, if you're accessing memory, you're essentially using a single integer value, which is the memory address. So you would put that memory address down and then you would use an instruction to load or store using that address. So pure integer, but the problem with using a pure integer is that you can always change that value. Mm. So generally a hacker comes in and they use some way of manipulating these addresses so they can take them out to where they shouldn't be. So what Cherry does is extend this concept of not just using an integer as an addressable, you know, location. It also sets bounds. You can only use this integer between the top bound and the bottom bound of a region of memory. And it also adds permissions as well. So it's how you can use that address on the memory as well. So we call these things capabilities. So a capability is a combination of an integer address with a set of rights to go with it. And capabilities have this long history in computing and security. It's they've been around a very long time. Again, probably right from the start of computing. Cambridge has a very old capability-based machine, I think, right, in their computer lab. So the idea isn't new, but the implementation that we have is new. But yeah, capabilities, in security terms, it's an unforgeable token. But in Cherry sense, we use it for protecting memory accesses. So for those people familiar with C and C++, you normally use pointers to access memory. And you can think of capabilities as a sort of smart pointer. It's a pointer with access permissions and bounds constraints. So it means that, you know, you can't do those buffer overflow attacks because as soon as you try to take your integer portion outside of your buffer, the hardware steps in and goes, nope, can't do this. And essentially what we do is we check on every load and store into the CPU at the hardware level. So every load and store, what would have been a pointer is now a capability, and every load and store is constrained to say, no, can't do that, or yes, you can. And on the permission side, we can narrow it down to, for instance, whether you can read, write, execute, you know, your typical file permissions that you have on a system. But we can do this for memory. So we can set region of memory as read-only or write-only. You can't put code in there, but you can put code over here. Okay. And it's quite a simple concept, but we can build really complicated security primitives on top of it. Mm.
So. I mean, thank you for explaining that. It sounds very effective. For our viewers and listeners, so for buffer overrun attacks, you mentioned kind of the main way that people would try and harness systems. So is that similar to, say, you know, DDoS attacks on websites, for instance, if in the same kind of vein, you know, if you can solve that, it's a bit like Pareto's law. So yes, Actually you're going to solve quite a lot of issues by fixing it at that level.
Yeah, I mean, memory issues in particular, I mean, you're looking at, you know, Microsoft did a study a couple of years ago on just how many vulnerabilities are memory related,
right,
in their software. And they found that 70% of all of their vulnerabilities were memory related.
Wow.
For the last 20 years.
For the last 20 years.
It's
and it hasn't changed.
Yeah,
hasn't changed.
Hasn't changed.
So from the CVEs that we spoke about earlier.
CVEs. for the 70% last 20 years that at least I've been working in the cyber field, it's always been the same problem.
Yeah, this is a very
sometimes 80%, right?
Yes.
Sometimes 80%.
Or more. I mean, recently we looked at the top 10 recent Android vulnerabilities, and 80% of them were memory-related vulnerabilities. Right. It was things like buffer overflows, it was heap overflows. I mean, this is something that we should have, you know, it's solvable now.
Yes.
Really should have a solution for this out there in the market.
I can completely agree. And Ron, if I can just come back to you on this. So one of the things that we see time and time again on the podcast, and in fact, it was something Carl had mentioned earlier about security being an afterthought or something that people didn't really think about, you know, when the mainframe was locked away because it wasn't connected. And sometimes security isn't really seen as something that necessarily sells, right? It's all about the product or the service and, you know, much like a gold plating exercise that you'll do. With, you know, the recent conflicts that you've mentioned, but also high-level cyber attacks, are you seeing security now by customers being more at the forefront of their minds and therefore taking this a lot more seriously than they should have done maybe years ago?
Yeah, well, I think everybody has been sensitive to it. But if you look at Cherry, so if you say that is 70, 80% or more of the CVEs, the issue was how to solve the problem, again, in an economically viable way.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you look at the trillion lines of code out there and you say, let's rewrite it in an inherent memory protected language like Rust, which is relatively new, you find that it's cost prohibitive, right? It's a decade and more than the gross domestic product of the world probably to go and redo that. So it becomes unviable. So the concept of Cherry has been around for a long time. It's been 10 years ago, I think.
And
it was Cambridge University with some sponsorship by DARPA in the US and UKRI here in the UK.
Yeah.
And the early, I would say, instances of it were not necessarily as economically viable as they are today. Mm. So, in fact, when we first started looking at this like 3 years ago, I said, no. I remember this from a decade ago. And even the smart professors that I worked with said the same thing. And it was like, no, it's not ready for prime time. It's a research thing. And lo and behold, when we started to look at it, and it was customers who gave us the idea, so it was very large customers, we realized that it really was ready for prime time. So, and by the way, it's not a unique thing to RISC-V at all. It's an open thing. We're looking at putting together an alliance with a lot of companies. It doesn't matter the instruction set architecture. ARM did a lot of really great work on it. Intel did work. MIPS did work back in the day. So what we realize is it's about ready for prime time. Now, what Carl said is true. It is incredibly invasive in the design. You have to have really brilliant architects, both security architects like Carl and CPU architects to be able to do it. And it took us some time to do it. So it's not an easy thing to do. But I think this is an economically viable way to do it. So, and I think by making it, we announced it at the end of last year, is we think that this is the first commercially available version of it, of a processor core that's for license. So we're a licensing company. So we're not a chip company. So all of the chip companies out there could license this technology for us. So I think it was just time and economics. And yes, I unfortunately believe that more and more people are going to be, let's say, forced into doing it. In fact, the question is going to be more towards the OEMs. Now that this is viable, right, are you going to protect your customers or not? And when we've looked at the number of really large Fortune 500 companies that have this, we'll give you a slide on it to show you, it's everybody. So this is not an isolated case to just some small companies that don't know how to do it. Really major corporations are going to have to make a choice. Do we go with a Cherry-based solution to stop 70 or 80% of these CVEs, or do we not? So I think it's going to be the consumers who are going to get frustrated with it. And especially, like I said, in critical infrastructure, I think it's going to start to be mandated. You're going to see the EU, the UK, and the US say, right, now that it's available, it's here, you really need to do this.
Yeah. I completely agree. And, you know, I think it's interesting, going back to Carl's point around, you know, how we talk around embedded systems. You know, what was it, Koenig and Ritchie, what was it, the 70s, C-book came out, I think, you know, and it's not until 5 years ago did we start talking about Rust as a potential, you know, in enterprise grade, at least, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like these issues are new by any stretch, but it's very interesting that sometimes it takes a business like yours, from a licensing perspective, to actually get it out in there into industry. So how can I'm an OEM, you know, I've got some issues around, you know, security or potential customers coming back with issues. How would I get myself involved with Codasip and with Cherry? What would I need to do to make that happen, Ron?
Well, you can email me and I'll sit down with the customers. But most of the OEMs, for instance, would want to buy a chip.
Yeah.
And so what we would do is work with them to find a SoC provider that we would work with that might be a licensee of us. So we could make sure that for their specific application, we would do that for them. Because again, we don't do chips. We're not a semiconductor company. We're an EDA and design IP company. So which the good news is, it's you don't have to have a single source from us. We can actually license it to whomever you want to. Now, if you're an OEM, which I think increasingly you're going to see more OEMs want to do their own silicon, because a lot of it now, the chip is the system.
Yes.
And so given that, if you have that capability inside, or you want to find a design services company, we work with a lot of those, we would help you specify it. And by the way, it's not just the Cherry piece. We could start with, you know, one-time programmable memory to put a cryptographic key in, to do device attestation, a hardware root of trust, all of the encryption algorithms. So Carl and team have a whole portfolio of IP that could culminate in something like Cherry. And we're particularly unique. Maybe I should a little commercial for Codasip. So Codasip and RISC-V, this combination, RISC-V is an open instruction set architecture, allows anybody to use it, but you can also change it. So you can make proprietary instructions. And Cherry stands for capability, as Carl described. It's a long-term word in security and architecture. Capability hardware extended RISC instructions. So it's actually changing the instruction set architecture for these particular things that you have to do to create the pointer, the smart pointers with the extensions onto it. So that's what we do. It's a custom compute application, which is why initially customers were coming to us. Wow, you guys do custom compute. Have you seen the security thing? Initially, I said 3 years ago, I said, no, it's not ready for prime time. Then we looked at it and it's like, oh, no, it really is. And so we could work with anybody who's interested in this, right? Just email me or write the info or whatever it is, customers portal at Codasip, and we would definitely spend some time with you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in terms of which, so we spoke about the OEMs and typically businesses where you'd imagine that this would be top of mind to have as a solution. Mm. What other industries out there could get involved or could see benefit from having Cherry involved within their systems outside of the typical customers, would you say?
Well, I would say probably industrial IoT and automotive are the two areas. Now, we have a slightly different version. Automotive frequently talks about functionally safe, so ISO 26262. We actually believe that safe and secure are two things that have to go together. In fact, I think it was Mary Barra who said that from GM. That's not really ours.
Yeah, right.
That's other people. So we think about that as being combined together. I read a very interesting article that was forwarded to by one our product management team that was in, I think, Germany. And they were talking about liability and the liability of auto industry. Or how do you have liability if there's a problem, like in a functionally safe or cybersecurity? And they were talking about, well, it's not a liability as long as you use state of the art.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right now, I think Cherry is the state of the art. So I think every automotive OEM all the way down to tier zero. So the entire supply chain should be looking at this, again, because it's practical. It's economically practical. It's not a single supplier. We license the technology so everybody can do it. Our processors, we just recently got ISO 26262, the certification of the process. So all of our processors are designed that way. So it's both functionally safe and with whatever cyber security fundamentals that you want to have in it. So I think industrial IoT, critical infrastructure, where would you target, right, from a military type of attack in automotive? Those are the two biggest ones. Now, of course, everything could have these problems, from simple consumer electronics to hack in from organized crime to baby monitors for doing that. So it could be everything, right?
Games consoles.
Games consoles.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's one. Yeah.
Games consoles could be huge.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, going back to automotive, of course, you've also got the convergence of two things, haven't you? You've got the internal combustion engine on the way out.
Yeah.
You know, and it becoming effectively more of a software-defined car now, as many years ago wouldn't at all. You'd just have the infotainment system. So I can imagine the need for security is just leveled up more and more within automotive as well.
Mm. Yeah, especially for EVs, right?
Yes.
It's a giant battery with a lot of chip software and yes, some mechanical engineering and design. Design is important, obviously, as well. But
And communications, because that's the other thing. You've now got vehicle-to-vehicle communications.
You really have to be careful about this, because you could genuinely look at something that really performs well, it's robust, but if it's missing basic security, and of course, if it's a communications technology, as Carl says, and it's the entree into your car, that's rather scary. And all of these active cables, you just have a bad chip in it that's shipping the information someplace else.
Yeah, agreed. I think one of the things that you said earlier, actually, was in terms of buffer overflow attacks building up, you know, 70, sometimes 80% of CVEs. Mm. Actually, you know, we need to worry about the here and now, really, rather than anything else, because it seems like in the past people haven't really focused on the here and now.
Exactly.
So if we can solve that, that's probably the most pressing concern, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and that is, I mean, Ron mentioned Rust earlier.
Yeah.
There is a push for, let's rewrite everything in memory-safe languages, which would be great, but it's not economically feasible or time feasible. I mean, at this point in time, we have to deal with the software that's there and is being used and is real. And then have a route in future maybe to migrate to these other technologies, which actually play very well with Cherry as well.
Carl, maybe one of the things you should talk about, because Carl, when he and the team was architecting it, we really thought about this. And one of the benefits of Cherry is you can have modal operations. You can have a Cherry mode and a non-Cherry mode. So you don't have to recompile everything for these new instructions. You can run some stuff outside.
One of my last questions to you today, gents, is really kind of predictions then for cybersecurity and the adoption of Cherry, say, over, you know, coming years. And maybe, Ron, you can answer this. There's, you know, I guess what you hope for, but also, you know, where do you see this going over the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, I really hope I'm wrong, Tom, but I'm, with all of the conflicts, the growing conflicts, the digitization of everything, I think we're going to see an explosion of these things, and we're going to see a lot of cyber attacks. And I think, unfortunately, I think it won't be a fast enough adoption, because it does take time. I mean, if I had to say something to OEMs and their suppliers, start now, because it takes time to make these things happen. It's a long design cycle for processors and through the market. So I think we're going to see a very unstable situation. A lot of money lost and a lot of bad things are going to happen. I think it will cause a refocusing on things like Cherry and Rust, and we're very pro all of these things. We just think that the Cherry implementation is the most economically viable. So I really hope that I'm wrong, but I think that's the likely scenario given the situation we're in geopolitically today.
I think you're right, for all it's worth. Sadly, I think ultimately it takes a really big incident to affect people and take it out of what they see as a you know, a kind of a technology and IT issue into the mainstream. And it's not until that really, really will happen, and it probably will, given the amount of CVEs that we talk about, till people really stand up and take notice. But hopefully in the work that you're doing today, that we can start to overcome some of these things and start to work that out. So thank you very much for coming on to the IoT podcast. I've really, really enjoyed it. I've got a question from our previous guest. So we asked our previous guests and a combination of our audience some questions. So, and I'm looking at my sheet here because I haven't actually read this question yet. But the question is, and maybe actually, Carl, I'll ask you to answer this if you can. Are there any challenges in applying Cherry to existing RISC-V designs?
Challenges, yes. Yeah. I mean, both from hardware and software. I mentioned on the low-level software, you do need to put more effort into supporting things like memory technology, for instance. So basic stuff like memcopy, for instance, in the system needs to take into account of Cherry. In terms of the hardware, that's the harder bit. You know, if you take an existing CPU design, you need to put all of the checks. I mean, I mentioned you do a check on load and store of every load and store. And you need to work out the complicated bounds equations to be able to do this. So, and it's quite complicated there. The other thing you do, you don't get anything for free. So our pointers becoming capabilities doubles the size of them in the register file. So you go from 64 bits to 128 bits, plus one additional bit, which is like an out-of-band integrity check bit. And all of this needs to be accounted for in the architecture.
Right.
So I wouldn't recommend trying to retrofit Cherry in. We took the approach of design it in from scratch, you know, from the start, and you get a much, you know, in terms of silicon area, much more performant and efficient system doing it that way.
Yeah, it sounds cleaner doing it that way.
Much, much cleaner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on to the IoT podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks.